today by reminding you that this Surf Friday, this is your one and only chance, if you can come, to earn a few points of extra credit, which hopefully you will not need, but it's always nice to have a cushion. If you can't make it, you have to email us in advance, and then we will give you some alternatives. Now, I want to start today by showing a few pictures and then, as usual, reverting to chalk. That what we have here is the same picture I showed last time, which is this is one membrane, this is another, and this is a third. And you notice that each membrane has this sort of three-layered appearance, two dark layers with some light in between, sort of like a sandwich. And one of the main questions today is going to be, what does this represent? We know it contains lipid and protein, but how are they organized? Now, one of the things we're going to talk today is to look at the membrane structure of the red blood cell, because this is the cell type whose membrane is best understood. And this picture is good because it shows you the dimpled nature of a red blood cell. Now, it isn't white. If this were a color photograph, it would look more like this. No eyes. But the idea is it has this sort of indentation in the middle, and it's red because of the hemoglobin inside. Now, these are whole cells, and they look nice and plump. And these are ghosts, so-called, because even in a color photograph, they would look the same. They have this white, ghost-like appearance. These are essentially membranes of the red blood cell with all the intracellular material emptied out. And because these are easy to get and to analyze, people know a lot about the membrane of the red blood cell. Also, as we'll discuss last time, these ghosts can be used to measure transport, because you can manipulate what's inside, you can manipulate the concentration outside, and you can see what happens. So we'll talk about that next time. But today we're going to talk about how you take these and chemically fractionate them, and what kinds of proteins you find, and how that generalizes to regular cells. Now, can I get a volunteer to get this for me? Somebody? Paul? Thank you very much. Just pull it down. I've got a foot. Thanks. Okay. We'll need all the boards eventually, but I'll start with a clean one. Okay. Now, the first question really is, what does that picture that we saw at the beginning in the first slide represent? We saw a structure that looks like this. And we know that it contains lipids. And these lipids are all amphipathic. Meaning that they all have one hydrophobic end and one hydrophilic end. And that's why it is customary to draw them something like this. Sometimes one puts in more detail, but the idea is that this is the polar hydrophobic end, and this is the hydrophobic nonpolar hydrocarbon side chain. Now, if you look at 3A at the top, sort of the bottom of the top half, it shows you how the lipids are thought to be arranged. That if this is the membrane, so this is the outside of the cell and this is the inside, we know that these lipids form a bilayer. So we have one layer of lipids like this, polar end toward the outside, hydrophobic in. And then we have another layer facing the other way. So that the hydrophilic polar ends face either the inside of the cell or the outside, and then you have a hydrophobic filling between them. Now, remember, this is a cross-section. So this would be a whole cell. This is a cross-section. But what that means is that this layer extends out, and the other layer extends out. So a bilayer is one layer of lipids this way, one layer of lipids this way. Now, one possibility is not drawn on your handout, is that the protein is actually entirely on the outside of this bilayer. So this is the lipid part. We're not going to go very much into the details of the lipid at all. We're going to talk mostly about the protein. Where is the protein? That's the first question. Now, the original thought was not the picture that you have drawn, which I'll leave there to complete, but an alternative idea, which is that, remember that three-layered picture in the electron micrograph? So what people thought at first was the dark stuff was the protein, and that the protein was located on the two sides of the lipid bilayer. This is often called the unit membrane hypothesis. The idea that your membrane is a sandwich, it's got a layer of protein, a bilayer of lipid, and then another layer of protein. So people, how are you going to get at the structure of a membrane? So one of the traditional methods is what is called Fries fracture. I think this is written on your handout on the left. Remember, we said that methods are going to be a major stress here, not just the result. Now, what Fries fracture means is that you take a sample of your cells or your membranes and you freeze it solid. And then you take what amounts to a sharp edge and give it a clop. So let's try our model here of what this looks like. So according to the unit membrane hypothesis, you've got a monolayer, lipid up, and a layer of protein. And then you've got another monolayer, another layer of protein. So the bread is the protein, and the cheese is the lipid. Now, what would happen if you froze this solid and you gave it a clop? How would you expect it to split? Down the protein or down the lipid? The lipid is the greasy stuff, and you would expect it to actually fracture probably something along these lines. And this is what people expected, and they did it. Now, according to this model, when you look on the inside, now notice you can't see the protein. The protein's underneath. But when you look from the inside, you should see two smooth surfaces. But that's not what they got. What they got was that each surface was full of bumps and holes. And how do you explain that? To explain that, they went on to another model, which is the one actually shown on your handout, which is usually called, in contrast to the unit membrane, this is called the fluid mosaic model. It's fluid because the lipid is fairly free to move around. It's called mosaic because the protein isn't all in one solid lump. It is spread around. So some proteins are over here. We'll call those A. Some proteins are on the other side. Some are on the inside. Some are on the outside. And some of them go all the way through. They are transmembrane proteins. Now, there's some other possibilities listed here, but we'll leave them for the moment. So the idea of this is that depending on which part of the membrane you look at, you're going to see a different arrangement of proteins and lipid. If you crack this part open, it will look smooth inside. But what will happen if you crack it here? So, to make that a little clearer, you can think about almonds in a Hershey bar. When you crack the Hershey bar, the almond doesn't split. It either goes with one side or the other, and you have either a hole or a bump. Now, to extend that to this model, suppose you have a transmembrane protein. Okay. Now, what's going to happen when you crack it? You're going to crack the lipid, but probably not the bread and the carrot. The carrot is either going to come out on this side or it's going to come out on that side. So let's just pick one. It comes out like this. Now the point is you'd have a hole on this side and a bump on this one. Every time you match them up, there'd be a bump on one side and a hole on the other. But since there are many transmembrane proteins, there would be both bumps and holes over here and both bumps and holes over here. And that is exactly what happens. And now if you look again, you can see the typical results written on top of the little picture where we've drawn it again. Here are your two different transmembrane proteins, and here is the lipid bilayer. Now I've drawn a little dotted line here because if I bothered to put it in, this is one monolayer, and this is another. Now, people refer to one half of the bilayer as one side, or one half, or a monolayer, or a leaflet. All those mean the same thing. And you can see here that there are two different leaflets or sides to this membrane, and especially to the bilayer. That this half is the half closest to the outside, while this half, or leaflet, is closer to the inside. Now, it's customary to refer to them as the E for exterior, and this is called the P. Now, that's the side facing the cytoplasm, which used to be called protoplasm, and that's where the name comes from. So this is the side, comes from the term protoplasm, really meaning cytoplasm. Now, in our example before, when we cracked it open, we were looking at the inner side of the E and the inner side of the P. Okay, so here is our membrane. What happens if we freeze fracture it and look in the electron microscope, which is what you do? So we freeze it. We're going to crack it open here or from this side, depending on how you look at it. And what's going to happen is that each of these proteins is going to go like the carrot with one side or the other. And that's how you get the picture shown on the right. Now, remember, if you're looking from the inside, which is the surface you would look at, the surface that was now open, this is called the E face, and this is called the P face, meaning the half of the membrane, P, that was close to the cytoplasm, but we're looking at the inside of the membrane side. That's called the face. And you would see a bump on one side and a correspondingly shaped hole on the other. Now, one of the parts that's interesting about this is when you actually do this with living cells, although you get both pumps and holes on both sides, you get more bumps on the P, usually. Now, what does that mean? That means that when we freeze fracture our membrane, that this protein is more likely to go with the P than it is with the E. Because we are more likely to get more bumps on this side. And that implies that just like my fingers, this protein is attached to something on the inside of the cell, usually the cytoskeleton. So this protein is anchored. If it's anchored, it is more likely to come out on the E side, excuse me, on the P side than the other. If it is not anchored, then it is 50-50 whether it will come out on the E or whether it will come out on the P. And we'll meet in some examples of anchoring proteins later on. Now, the fluid mosaic model has one other aspect that, strictly speaking, as you can see from that picture, you don't have a solid layer of protein here. You have a bunch of individual proteins and a different set over here. So it would be probably more accurate to take this cheese and then put a bunch of crackers on top. And the crackers are pretty close to each other, but it's crackers, not a solid layer of bread. Same thing, different kind of crackers over here. Now, we want to say just a word about the lipid or fluid part of it before we do the details of the mosaic or the protein part. If you come back here and look at this bilayer, how does it sort of get set up? Now, the reason this is an issue is that in most cells, the lipids are synthesized on the surface of the endoplasmic reticulum, the ER. So the enzymes that make lipid are actually on the cytoplasmic side. And as the lipid is made, it is inserted into the membrane. Now, we know once lipid is inserted into a membrane, a vesicle can form and carry that lipid somewhere else. So the major way that lipids get from one place to another is with vesicles, although it's not the only way. But if you come back and think about this more closely, the problem is that we're always inserting lipid from the same side. We're always putting in new lipid from the cytoplasmic side. And in fact, that means, the way I drew this picture, this would have to be a piece of the ER. If this is the external membrane of the cell, If this is the external membrane of the cell, then vesicles would reach it carrying lipid from the ER. But if we draw the ER over here, here's the ER membrane. Remember, the ER is a tube. What we're saying is that the enzymes that make the lipid are here, usually tethered to the membrane. And so the lipid is being inserted from the outside of the ER. So if that's true, you would expect this side to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and there wouldn't be anything over here. Well, the reasoning is, to step back a second, is that we are pretty sure that lipids can move within the plane of the membrane. And there are experiments that demonstrate that most lipids can. So if this is the plane of the membrane, lipids can move around this way. So we understand that if you put a lipid here, it could end up over there or over there. But the question is, how does the lipid end up on the other side? The other half or leaflet of the bilayer. We're saying that lateral movement in the plane of the membrane is actually quite fast. But movement across the membrane is relatively slow. It's very slow. It's hours versus probably versus seconds. And that's usually called a flip-flop. That is the moving of a molecule, an amphipathic molecule of lipid, from one leaflet to the other side. Now, you understand why this is a problem. You have to move the polar part all the way across the hydrophobic layer to get it to the other side. So this is extremely slow without an enzyme. So you actually need enzymes in the cell to allow the movement of lipid from one side to the other. So this requires an enzyme. In some cases, it requires energy if the lipid is being moved against its gradient. It doesn't require an external source of energy like ATP if it's going down its gradient. How that works, we'll get to later. Now, in many membranes, the lipids on the two leaflets are not the same. And part of that is because, that is, the composition of the two leaflets is not the same, because if there is no flipase, or whatever you want to call the enzyme, then the lipid put in on this side, that kind stays on this side. If there is flipase, the lipid equilibrates, and so on. So it is possible to have a membrane in which the distribution of lipid is not the same on the two halves. Now, for now, that's basically what I want to say about the lipid part, and now I want to talk about the protein part. So let me ask before I go on if there are any questions about so far. Yeah?
You were saying that it's made in the cytoplasm, but I thought that was on the inside, and you're saying it comes from the outside.
No, she's saying, I said it was made in the cytoplasm, which is on the inside, and this looks like the outside. Now, I realized when I started to draw that picture over there that I was drawing it wrong. And the problem here is that inside and outside can refer to inside and outside the cell, or it can refer to inside or outside the organelles. So outside this organelle, the ER, is inside the cell or inside the cytoplasm. So we weren't saying the lipid is made outside the cell. We're saying the lipid is made in the cytoplasm outside of the ER. So this would be the lumen of the ER. This would be the cytoplasm. Yeah?
So are we constructing the cell membrane here or the endoplasmic?
So are we constructing the cell membrane or the endoplasmic reticulum membrane? So that's a good question, but the answer is that vesicles, but you're constructing the ER membrane, but remember all the parts of the endomembrane system are connected, and the plasma membrane is essentially part of the endomembrane system. So once you construct the ER membrane properly, vesicles can butt off, and these vesicles have a bilayer around them, a single membrane, but a bilayer with protein, and this can fuse with the plasma membrane and add lipid to the plasma membrane. So ultimately, we're constructing almost all of the membranes in the cell. Yeah?
Is the flipping and the lateral movement the same in the plasma membrane, or like, are the rates the same in the plasma?
Are the rates of movement, both lateral and flipping, the same in the various membranes? As far as I know, they are without an enzyme. But the flipping rate is different in different membranes because of the presence or absence of enzymes, of the appropriate enzymes. There was one more question, or is that it? No. Okay, two more, and then we have to go on.
When you have the fatty tails of the phospholipids, do they ever overlap like this?
Do the hydrophobic tails overlap? Do these two overlap? And as far as I know, the basic answer is no. Okay, there was one more back there.
You talked about the membrane proteins going through one bilayer, but in that picture, are you indicating it possible to go through two bilayers?
What's a bilayer? This is a bilayer, this is a bilayer, this is a bilayer, and this is a bilayer. So a transmembrane protein would be like this.
The one on the right, that's
here?
Yeah.
That's a bilayer also. That's the plasma membrane.
This I drew inside the
lumen. This?
Yeah.
This just represents the end of the fact that the ER, remember, is hollow.
Okay.
So what we're saying is this thing is a bilayer. and it's wrapped around, and this is a space in the lumen. No, it doesn't go across this way. Okay. We often draw the ER like this. Sometimes this is a cross-section of the ER, and it means this is a bilayer, this is a bilayer, and this is the lumen. Sometimes it means this is a bilayer, and the other one is down here, and this is the lumen. So I will try and be careful to label it. Okay, I'm going to stop here, but if you have questions left at the end, please feel free to ask. Because I want to go on now and talk about the proteins. Now, let's just say what the terms are here for them. If you look at that picture up there, and I guess I better draw it again. Our basic picture has a protein that goes all the way through, and then it has proteins which I label A, B, and C. C goes all the way through. A and B are on the side. Now, how do you classify these various proteins? And perhaps the easiest way to see that is to look on the bottom half of 3A. How these proteins are considered depends completely on experimental protocols of how they were isolated and how people got to examine them. It's pretty clear that C is in a different category from A and B. But where this comes from is when you start with a cell, you can isolate the membranes separate from the rest of the cell. Most of the time when we talk about enzymes, we're talking about soluble enzymes. So what you do is you break the cell open, you add some liquid, and you make a shaken extract, and then you centrifuge out all the quote-unquote junk, which includes the membranes. But here we're sort of doing the reverse. We're taking the cell, opening it up, spilling its guts, and saving the membrane. And so when you do that, you now take the membrane, and we're sort of saying you took this, and you sort of fished it out, and anything that was stuck with it came with it. So all of these proteins would come with the lipid. And now what you do is you treat the membrane with chemicals that do not disrupt the bilayer and that break only weak bonds otherwise, no covalent bonds. So the examples here are changes in the salt or the pH. These break weak bonds, but not covalent bonds, and they don't disrupt the bilayer. So what's going to happen when you do that is you're going to knock off proteins that are associated with the polar heads by weak bonds. So A and B are actually going to fall off. Anything that falls off when you do that is called an extrinsic or peripheral protein. And I'm sorry you can't see over here, but it's all written on your handout. Similarly, anything that stays with the membrane is called an intrinsic, which stays, I should say, with the bilayer and the rest of the membrane, is called an intrinsic or an integral protein. Now, it's pretty obvious here that A and B are extrinsic proteins, and C is an integral protein. And the only way you're going to get C loose is by dissolving the lipid bilayer. But there's another category here, if you look back at the top. You notice there's some proteins that look sort of like this. I'm going to call these E and D. These are proteins that are considered intrinsic or integral. Now, why? They are covalently attached to the head of lipid. Now, the case of E, the protein part, which is meant to be here, the protein part is attached to the head of a lipid in the E part of the membrane, so in E leaflet, so this protein is sticking outside of the cell. On the other hand, D is a protein that is attached to the head of a lipid in the P part of the membrane. And so this protein is sticking out into the cytoplasm. So that's why we've said that integral membrane proteins can be subdivided into lipid-anchored and transmembrane. And the lipid-anchored ones can be sticking out on the inside or the outside. Now, there is one other category which is not shown here in your picture. There are a few proteins that appear to sort of go halfway in to the lipid layer and not all the way across. Proteins that look like this. Now, we are going to ignore, for the most of this class, cases E and D, and what you might call F. And we're going to concentrate on proteins like A, B, and C. If you take more advanced classes or you read more advanced books, you will in fact encounter cases of E, D, and F. And you may meet an occasional one in a problem, but we're not going to focus on that. Now, going back to transmembrane proteins, however, they come in two varieties which are worth thinking about. And this is perhaps, I mean, I can draw it and I can also illustrate it. So if we draw our membrane again, over here, here's the bilayer, and we have a transmembrane protein. One possibility is that the protein goes across the membrane only once. Now you see a protein like this has three separate areas or so-called domains. This part is intracellular. And the part that's sticking out into the part that's sticking outside of the cell is, of course, extracellular. Say this protein has three domains. It has an intracellular domain, it has an extracellular domain, and it has a transmembrane domain. And this is often written much the way we were writing one of the proteins last time. People would write the protein like this, and it's understood that this is the amino end, because that's always on the left, and this is the carboxyl end. And people would write something like this. So this would represent the transmembrane domain. Now, depending on which way it was, suppose this is the amino end. Then this is the extracellular domain, and this is the intracellular. And people would write this showing the approximate sizes of the different domains. Now, this part here for this kind of protein is called a single-pass protein. So it would look something like, you have the extracellular domain, and then you have the part that goes through the membrane, and then you have the intracellular domain. And in most of these proteins, the part that transverses the membrane, the intracellular domain, is an alpha helix. And it's usually about 25 amino acids long. That's what it takes to make a helix long enough to fit across a bilayer. So usually there's an alpha helix here. Now the three-dimensional shape of the intracellular domain or the extracellular domain can vary. Vary in size, vary in shape, depending on the function of this protein. Now, this is one class of transmembrane proteins. It's a single-pass protein. Now, by the way, we've mentioned that this protein can be anchored here or attached directly or indirectly to the cytoskeleton, so that when you freeze fracture this membrane, pops out on the P face. Alternatively, it could not be anchored, in which case not only can it float in the membrane, but when you freeze fracture, it could go either way. Now there is one, the other kind of protein is called a multipass. Now again, if I draw my membrane, it means the protein is something like this. Now, the protein can go across many times. So that means this is an alpha helix. This is an alpha helix. This is an alpha helix. That's one way to do it. But the other way to do it is have the protein be folded into a beta sheet in these sections. This is not always folded the same way. But this protein, now, these can be altered. I don't want to say altered. These can be set up so the amino end is outside and the carboxyl is in, or vice versa. They can be set up so both ends are on the outside, or both ends are on the inside, all of the above. There's all different kinds. But a protein like this has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 transmembrane domains. And you notice it has 1, 2, 3 intracellular ones and 3 extracellular ones. Now, they can be grouped together. But if you were to write it this way, it would have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 extracellular transmembrane domains. If this were the amino end, then we'd put that here, etc. Now, the proteins are usually drawn this way. But often, that is not their 3D architecture. But instead, they have all these various transmembrane proteins, domains. Now, these could be alpha helices, or this could be a beta sheet. But the critical thing is that many of these multipass proteins are actually folded to form a circular structure. Now, that means that they're embedded in the membrane. So there's lipid bilayer out here, but in here is a hydrophilic pore, because the side chains that are sticking out are often hydrophilic. So this is one way you make a door or a pore or a channel in the membrane, by having a protein wrapped around, allowing things to go in and out. Now, this leads to the question of what are these for? And before I answer that, I want to say one more thing about structure, and then we'll talk about function. We've already said that these transmembrane proteins can be single pass or multipass. They can be anchored or not anchored. So they can be single or multi. They can be anchored or not. They all have multiple domains because of what's in the membrane and what's sticking out either side. Now, many of these proteins have short branched carbohydrate chains added to the side chains of amino acids. So many of these are what are called glycoproteins, meaning they're basically proteins, but they have a little carbohydrate added on. And since those chains are short and branched, it's often written something like, drawn something like this. The function of this is not really known, but it's extremely common. And the sugars are always added on the equivalent of the extracellular domain. Now, why they are always found on that side and not on the other has to do with the way they're made and the location of the enzymes that catalyze the addition of these sugars. These proteins are now in the plasma membrane, and the sugars are on the outside. But when these proteins were being made, remember, they were inside the cell somewhere. And when they were inside the cell, the only side that was exposed to enzymes was this side. And we'll explain how that is in a bit. Now, what do these proteins do? We already explained, when talking about the multipass proteins, some of these proteins are involved in transport. They provide a sort of door in the membrane or a hole so that hydrophilic things can get across the membrane. And there are various variants on this. Some of them are just doors that are open and things can flow down their gradient through the hole. Some of these, though, transport proteins, don't just say, please. Some of them act more like pumps. They push things through. And they push them against their concentration gradient. And they're said to be pumps. We'll talk more about these next time, what the distinction is, how you tell, how they operate. Now, another thing they can be is receptors. On the surface of the cell, this is the bilayer. Many of these transmembrane proteins have an extracellular domain that binds something. Something sticks to them, small or large. And when that something comes along and sticks, they change conformation. Now, what happens as a result of this change in conformation? Notice the change in conformation is on the inside. The binding of the signal or the molecule is on the outside. So one thing this can do is simply act as a signal. This ligand, or ligand as it's called, which is what you call something that binds to a receptor, this can simply be a signal molecule. And the change in conformation in the receptor triggers events inside the cell. So one function of receptors is signaling. Many hormones work in this way. Many neurotransmitters work in this way. The hormone or the neurotransmitter binds on the inside. The receptor changes conformation on it binds on the outside. The receptor changes conformation on the inside, and this leads to a series of events. Alternatively, sometimes the whole point of binding is this receptor acts as a trap, and now the trapped molecule can be taken into the cell. And when you trap large molecules and take them into a cell, that's called receptor-mediated endocytosis, or RME. So in other words, the receptor can act to provide signaling, or it can provide transport of stuff into the cell. Usually large molecules, small molecules go in through these doors. But large molecules go in a different way, as we will explain. Now, sometimes the result is both. Sometimes the signal molecule binds, and then after it binds, it's taken into the cell, often to be destroyed. Because once you got the signal, you want to get rid of it. So it can be either one, transport or signaling, or both. Now, there is another function, that important function, that transmembrane proteins can serve. They can serve as connectors. So that's the third one. Remember, there's a cytoskeleton down here. There's a lot of stuff inside the cell. And there is material on the outside of the cell, which is called the extracellular matrix. Usually abbreviated EC. CM. Now, as you've begun to realize, cell biology is full of acronyms. We sort of can't avoid it, but I'll try and be sure to define them every time they come up. So some proteins act as a link between the inside and outside of the cell, sometimes just to hold everything together physically, and sometimes to convey signals, and sometimes both. So these transmembrane proteins can be involved in transport of small molecules, signaling, transport of big molecules, connections, or all of the above. And we will meet examples of all of these as we go. Now, I think it makes it a little clearer if we consider a real example of all this. All of this is talking theoretically. If you take a real membrane apart, what kind of proteins do you find? And so let's do an example of that and then have questions. Now, if you're going to take a membrane apart and look at the proteins, you want to pick a membrane that's easy to get and that's only one kind of membrane at a time. That's one of the reasons for using red blood cells. Red blood cells are very easily obtained. They're plentiful and they're cheap because you can get expired blood. That is, blood that sat around too long and not been used for transfusions is readily available. So you can get all the red blood cells you want. Red blood cells have, however, the additional advantage of having no internal membranes. The average eukaryotic cell has many organelles inside. It has a nucleus, it has mitochondria, it has an ER, it has a Golgi, the works. Red blood cells in humans do not have any of those things. Their precursors are regular, ordinary cells with everything. But when the red blood cell matures, it ditches almost all of these structures. They are taken apart and the pieces are degraded. So that a mature human red blood cell has a plasma membrane on the outside. Remember, this is a bilayer with many associated proteins. But inside, there are no organelles, no nucleus. That's all been lost. There are proteins, of course, and other things inside. And the major protein is hemoglobin. It's not the only one. There are also the enzymes of glycolysis, etc. But the main thing this has become is really a package of hemoglobin with a lot of other stuff to enable the hemoglobin to work. So this is a cell that carries hemoglobin around. So the hemoglobin can pick up oxygen in your lungs, ditch it in your tissues, pick up CO2 in your tissues, ditch it in your lungs. So if you start with this cell and you crack it open, you can wash out all the contents and be left with pure membrane. And those are those ghosts you were looking at. So you lose the cytoplasmic contents and keep the ghost, which is essentially pure membrane. Now, you have to open the cell up in order to wash out the contents. And depending on how you do this, the cell can just reseal. The membrane, that is, can reseal. And it forms a cell-shaped and sized membrane envelope with nothing inside, or whatever you washed it with will be inside. You can control what is inside. Or you can treat this to break it up into smaller pieces, and they will also spontaneously reseal into a sealed vesicle. Depending on how you do this, either the whole ghosts or the pieces can reseal right side out or wrong side out. Now, to explain that, let's go back and start with a cell, and we'll put some transmembrane proteins in. Maybe we'll do it this way. Okay. Now, we break it open, wash out the cytoplasm. And what do we mean by right side out and inside out? we get cells and vesicles, and some of them look like this, and some of them look like that. So this is a case which has retained the same topology as the original. The proteins that were on the outside are still on the outside. And here, the protein domains that were sticking on the outside are now on the inside. So you can get either right side out, or wrong side out, or inside out. Now, you understand this is useful because this, if you now examine the proteins that are sticking out, that's what was sticking out. But you can't examine the proteins that were on the inside. But here you can now see whatever is sticking out is what used to be on the inside, and you can characterize it. So this turns out to be very useful. And you'll have some problems which discuss in your book how you make use of this. Now, what people did then was to take red blood cell ghosts, that is, red blood cell membrane, and to break them up. Just the process we were talking about before. You take the cell, you get the membrane, and then what you do is you wash it by changing the salt or the pH, and you get intrinsic proteins and extrinsic. Now, to make it clearer what you get from red blood cells, we actually have a picture on the other side of your handout. And this shows the major intrinsic and extrinsic proteins of the red blood cell. So here again, now, the reason I drew it this way is there are actually two major transmembrane proteins. One is single pass, and this is multipass. This is one of those multipass ones that's wrapped into a circle. But these are the intrinsic proteins. What about the extrinsic ones that wash off? What are they like? Well, you notice down here there's these long sort of stretched out proteins. There's a web of these proteins right underneath supporting the membrane. And this has two major components which you can see here. The stretched out protein is called spectrin. And the spectrin form chains are connected into a web by short microfilaments. So this is actin. And remember, actin forms these double chains of globs that twist into a fiber. That's a microfilament. And so this forms very short microfilaments. And the very short microfilaments hold the spectrin web together. Now, this was discovered in red blood cells. But we now think that virtually every eukaryotic cell has something very much like this underneath the plasma membrane. It has a web of spectrin and actin supporting the membrane and keeping its shape. Now, the other major peripheral protein that's shown here is one that actually connects the multipass protein to the actin spectrin web. And since this anchors the big protein, it's called anchoring. Now, in this particular picture, it doesn't look like the single pass one is anchored. But in fact, we now know that it is by a much smaller protein, which is known as 4-1. Now, that protein is known as protein 4-1, and this protein is sometimes called band 3. And the reason for all that is, how did you isolate these proteins? The extrinsic proteins can be washed off. But how can you look at intrinsic proteins? They're an intrinsic or integral part of the bilayer. So the only way you can get them loose is to dissolve the bilayer. So the way you get all of the proteins together is to take the membrane and dissolve it in detergent. And if you make a solution in detergent, you separate the lipids and you separate the lipid-soluble proteins. And then you can run them on a, you can do electrophoresis on a gel. So people took membranes dissolved in detergent and ran it on a gel and stained the gel. And the first time they did it, they saw four bands. So they called them band 1, band 2, band 3, and band 4. And then as their methods got better, they saw that some of these were really multiple. And that's where 4-1 comes from. It's next to band 4, but it's a little different. And band 3, this one, is just third from the end. Now, we know the function of this protein. We don't know really the function of that one. But band 3 is now known to be an anion exchanger. And I'll explain what that is. So it's called band 3 or the anion changer, or it actually exchanges chloride and bicarb. So it's also called the chloride bicarb exchanger. Now some older books call it a channel. It turns out that in a channel and an exchanger have different properties, and it is not a channel. But the subtleties of this we'll get to next time. We won't have time to explain that today. But what we mean by the fact that it's an exchanger is that every ion of chloride that goes through, an ion of bicarb goes through in the other direction. You can't move one without the other. So instead of being just a plain old channel that sits there and what goes through, it's more like a revolving door where you have to have two guys pushing on both sides. And only when you have the two of them can you flip it. More details to follow. So the peripheral proteins here are ancrin, spectrin, actin, and this thing we've called 4-1 is also involved in holding everything else together as well. If you look at a better picture, you'll see it's in more than one place. Now, this, remember, is a cross-section. It may make more sense if you see it from the outside of the cell. Remember, the cell is a sphere. And if we look from the top of the sphere, it looks something like if you look from the curve from the outside, you see that there is a network where at these vertices, you have actin, you have short microfilaments and or protein 4-1, and these connecting spokes are spectrin. So from the side, the picture just looks sort of like a webby mush. But if you look from the outside, you see that it's organized into this kind of network pattern, which is clear, more like a geodesic dome kind of support. Now, there is one other feature shown in this picture, which is important. It's clear just from looking at this that this is single pass. It's not clear from looking, but this is a multipass. But both of these proteins have those short carbohydrates on the end. These are both glycoproteins. And as we've explained, as you can see in the picture, the sugars are always on the exterior side, not on the interior. Now, we said before that it takes something like 25 amino acids. This is an alpha helix, and it takes somewhere between 20 and 30, usually about 25 amino acids to get across. As the way you said it before, this would be the E part, this would be the P. And this is about 7 turns of an alpha helix. Just to get some sense of size and relationship. and this distance is about 5 nanometers. And these details are largely for reference for those of you who like it quantitative. Now, what about the function of these two proteins? Virtually all cells have some kind of spectrin, ankyrin, etc. like structure under the membrane. But exactly which proteins they have in the membrane depends on the function of that particular cell. And we know the function of this protein. We don't actually know the function of this one. I think this is the most common protein in red blood cells, and it has a name. It's called glycophorin. It's actually a family of proteins, so there's glycophorin A, glycophorin B, etc. Now, as I said, we don't really know the function of this protein. What we do know, though, is that this short carbohydrate, or oligosaccharide, is very highly negatively charged. It's a modified sugar. And so one thought, and one possibility, is that having all these negatives on the outside prevents red blood cells from clumping. Because they don't attract each other, they repel. So it's been suggested that that's really the function of this protein, which is to keep them, red blood cells, from sticking together. Another possible function is that red blood cells are made in tremendous amounts. They last about 60 days, half-life, and then they're destroyed. I think it's 60 days. They don't last that long, and they're always being turned over. And how do you tell an old red blood cell from a new, fresh, young blood cell? So one thought is perhaps these sugars erode or are gradually degraded with age. As the red blood cell goes around and around, they get worn off. And so it may be that the age of a red blood cell is reflected in the length of these chains, and that controls when they are degraded and when they are allowed to recycle. Now, we do know one of the functions of this, but it's not the natural function. One of these glycophorins is the receptor for the malaria parasite. Now, when we call a protein the malaria receptor, do we mean that the real function of that protein is to give you malaria? Of course not. What we mean is it's been discovered that the protein that the malaria parasite sticks to in order to get into a cell, what traps it is this protein. It means that the malaria parasite has taken advantage of the fact or been selected to stick to this protein. What the real job for us of that protein is, we don't know. We also know that another member of this family is responsible for the M and N blood groups, whose inheritance we talked about last semester. The M and the N version differ in only a few amino acids, and they determine antibody reactions, but again, what the real function is, nobody knows. Now, we don't know much about glycophorin, but we know the function of glycophorin, but we know a lot about the function of the exchanger, or BAM3. And that's what I want to talk about next. In general, the proteins in a membrane, as we said, are specific to a specialized cell type. Each differentiated cell type does something special, and it has to have special proteins to do that. And we said that one of the things that red blood cells do is they carry oxygen and CO2 around. In your tissues, metabolism is going on all the time, and that's generating CO2. Now, that CO2 is a gas, so it just bubbles out of the cells and gets into the blood. And the blood has to carry it back to the lung so it can be breathed out. The only catch is that CO2 is not very soluble. So the amount that it can dissolve in the blood is not very large. And yet, the amount of CO2 you breathe out is very large. So the trick to this is that the CO2 actually enters your red blood cells. And you see the red blood cell in the middle of 3B. We've drawn one sideways. That CO2 from the tissues can enter the liquid blood, and it can enter the cell because it's a gas. It can just get there. But now, once it's inside, there is an enzyme. And this enzyme is found only inside red blood cells, not in the liquid blood. And it converts CO2 to bicarb plus proton. And the enzyme that does this is called carbonic anhydrase. It's a famous enzyme because it has one of the highest turnover numbers known. Now, that means that inside the red blood cell, you can convert CO2 to bicarb. Bicarb is very soluble. So if you can get the bicarb into the blood will soak up lots of it, and you can keep doing this. But the trick is, how are you going to get the bicarb out of the cell? CO2 is a gas, but bicarb is an ion. Remember, this is a bilayer. This is hydrophobic. So to get across, it has to have some kind of transporter, a door, or something. And it's this anion exchanger, this protein band 3, is critical here in that it allows chloride to enter the cell and bicarb to leave, or as it turns out, vice versa. Because remember, it's an exchanger. It can go either way. But one ion has to go one way and the other ion has to go the other. Now notice that the net effect here is not to change charge because you switched one negative ion for another. But the bicarb can leave the cell and go now into the blood, and the blood can soak up lots and lots of bicarb, pulling the CO2 from the tissues. Now, when the blood gets around to the lungs, this process has to be reversed. Now, let's be sure everybody has this right. Suppose you have a red blood cell, say, in the tissues, and you have one in the lungs. So what's going to happen to bicarb? CO2 and chloride. Are they going to go in or out under these two conditions? Fill this in with in or out, in or out, in or out, all six places. So do it, discuss it with your neighbor, and be sure you agree. Physiological real role in the body of this enzyme and this process. So we just did the tissue. So in the tissues, what's going to happen to bicarb? Is it going to go in or out? Relative to the red blood cell, it's going to go out, just as in our picture. And CO2? It's going to go in. And chloride? is going to go in exchange for the bicarb. But now when you get to the lungs, what's going to happen? The bicarb is going to go which way? It's actually going to go back in exchange for chloride. So chloride is going to go out, and CO2 is going to go out. Now, are there any questions about this? Yeah?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand how you set it up, so I'm confused why CO2 is going into the tissues.
Okay, so is this a tissue cell or a red blood cell in the circulation next to the tissue? Okay. This is a red blood cell next to the tissue. This is a red blood cell, not a lung cell. That's important. Anything else? There's an implication here of something that I want to point out. Can this enzyme catalyze the reaction in both directions? Can any enzyme catalyze a reaction in both directions? Well, opinion is divided, I think, here on this one. By chemical arguments, an enzyme can catalyze a reaction in both directions. Because remember, it doesn't change the equilibrium constant, which is the ratio of rate versus rate. Or you can think of it in terms of the transition state, it stabilizes the transition state. So that reduces the activation energy from this side, and it reduces the activation energy from that side. So in chemical terms, an enzyme can do it either way. It just depends on conditions, whether it gets a chance. There is perhaps a more common sense analogy way to explain this that is maybe more convincing. An enzyme is like a tool, like a screwdriver. You need the screwdriver to get the screw in. You need the screwdriver to get the screw out. You need it both ways, and it's actually equally effective in both. And so that analogy follows, but the chemistry, of course, is the real explanation. Okay, so this is why this is such an important enzyme and function. Now, I started a little bit late, so I'm going to talk for maybe another 5 minutes, and if you absolutely have to go, please feel free. Because there's one more thing I want to talk about, and that is what is called the extracellular matrix, which we mentioned before. Everything we have talked about so far is inside the cell or part of this membrane. But we implied over here that there is stuff outside the cell, which is important. Now, we know where everything outside the cell came from. Where was it made? All the enzymes for making everything are inside the cell. So if there are proteins or carbohydrates that are outside, they were actually made inside and then secreted. And we will talk about how that works later. But I wanted to talk briefly about the major components of the extracellular matrix, and that's written out on the bottom of your handout. As implied in that picture, there are structural proteins in the extracellular matrix that provide support. And in fact, the most common protein in your body is an extracellular support protein, collagen. Another one is elastin. And I mention these because these are major proteins in the skin. Remember, these are extracellular matrix, so they're in between the cells of your skin. Now, what happens with aging, which is probably not something you're worried about yet, but that what happens is the collagen gets cross-linked and the elastin gets degraded. The collagen provides sort of the strength and the elastin, the elasticity, and so your skin gets more fragile and more stiff and less elastic. And that's the basis of a lot of the beauty industry, which is very happy about this because they can sell very expensive creams that are supposed to fix this. Now, these proteins provide the strength, but they have to be glued together. So what holds them together is the so-called adhesive proteins. And the two most famous examples of that are fibronectin and laminin. Remember, I warned you last time when we were talking about lamins in the nucleus that there is something with a similar name. Laminin is found in layers in the extracellular matrix. That's how it got its name. And it is part, a major protein, in what is called the basal lamina, therefore the name. Or what was called in the older literature, a basement membrane. It's called a basement membrane because it's often found, it's a thin layer, so that's why it's called a membrane. And it's found underneath cells supporting them often. But it is not, that's the basement part, but it is not a membrane in the sense that it's not a bilayer of lipid. It has no lipid at all. It's just like a mat of primarily laminin and collagen. And it's a woven mat of the two of them, sort of like felt, that supports many of the layers of cells in your body. Now, fibronectin is interesting because unlike the lamins we talked about last time, we've talked now about gene families several times, that you have multiple versions of the same gene making multiple variants of the same protein. You make many variants of fibronectin, but the human genome has only one copy of the gene. And the reason is that this gene, the transcript of this gene can be spliced in many, many different ways. And so these are splice variants made from a single gene, not the results of a gene family. Now, the final category here is a proteoglycan. These basically form a gel, and the gel forms a matrix that holds everything else. And the gel can be thicker or thinner. You know that bone, for example, is extremely solid. It starts out like this, but it becomes solid. That's solid extracellular matrix. And what's the stuff in your nose? Cartilage. Cartilage has a lot of collagen, but it's not, the extracellular matrix isn't as hard. Now, a proteoglycan is in many ways is a combination of sugar and protein. We already mentioned a thing called a glycoprotein. A glycoprotein is basically a protein with some short sugars on it. A proteoglycan is the reverse. It is a little bit of protein with a lot of very long sugars on it. So the protein, it's got a short protein and very long sugars. And these sugar chains consist of repeating sugars. So this would be A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B. And they're usually modified sugars, often amino sugars. So this thing itself, this long sugar chain, and there's a table of this in your notes, so you'll be able to keep it straight, not so you can memorize it, but so you'll know what they're talking about, that this long thing is called a glycosaminoglycan or a mucopolysaccharide. And both of those terms are used. The table here is largely for reference, so you know what people are talking about. Now, I think what we'll do is we'll stop here and draw a quick summary diagram of this next time, and then we're going to talk about how one cell is connected to another.